Welcome to an all-new Off the Wall on YesNetwork.com. Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma give their opinions on the latest happenings surrounding Yankees baseball, as well as dive into the hottest topics in the sports world. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Off the Wall podcast here on YesNetwork.com. Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma coming back at you. Guess who's back? Back again. It's both of us.
Yes, sir.
After a little bit of a hiatus, I put myself in a penalty box for 3 days because of my brutal Rangers Capitals prediction. I was back at it on Thursday, yesterday.
I will tell you this. Yes. I totally agreed with you on the prediction, so I'm right there. I'm a Devils fan, so I don't care. Yeah, I agreed with you.
We'll talk about those New York Rangers in just a bit. Their season is probably going to end tomorrow up in Boston, but we'll get to that in a bit. First, let's talk some New York Yankees baseball,
yes,
Joe.
Yes, sir.
We got to get to some hockey. You're wearing your Niedermeyer Dead jersey, your Devils, Scott Niedermeyer jersey. So we'll talk Devils, not Devils, but we'll talk hockey in just a bit. But first, the Yankees. And, you know, despite their series loss to the Baltimore Orioles, it's still amazing what this team has been able to do this year. You know, but the one thing that cannot happen, and you kind of... When Hiroki Kuroda took that line drive from Manny Machado off his right calf on Wednesday, you kind of said to yourself, uh-oh. Because, you know, this lineup hasn't really been exposed for what it could be.
Right.
For what people thought it should be. And the main reason for that, and I started talking about this yesterday, but Joe, as everybody knows by now, you cover the team.
Mm-hmm.
For 81 games for YesNetwork.com, along with Lou DiPietro.
Who's the man? He's great.
Who will give a big assist to on this one for his injury update that he has up there on YesNetwork.com. I'm going to go through it here with you here on the podcast. But if you want to read it yourself, you could just go to YesNetwork.com and do yourselves a favor and follow Louis D. It's at Lou, LouDiPietro, yes. That is on the Twitter. But this is where the Yankees cannot get hurt. They could not lose Hiroki Kuroda. They're not going to. He feels fine. He's going to make his next start. But if you start seeing, and I said it yesterday, Joe, and just get your thoughts on it, but this is the analogy I used. That starting rotation, the Yankees pitching in general, but I think that starting rotation more is the San Andreas fault to this 2013 season.
It starts and ends with the Yankees starting pitching rotation. If they're not getting good starts out of their starters, which is supposed to be the strength, the uber strength of this team, then you're right. The 2013 season is going to be a failure. It's not going to be a success. Really, the Yankees have had three things working for them this season. They've had good to great starting pitching. And you know what? CC Sabathia hasn't even been himself yet. So
no.
It's been
and you know that 10 to 12 game run is coming for him.
Right. And he basically with Sabathia, you're getting good starts out of him, un-Sabathia-like starts. He's giving up a lot of hits lately, but he's still a horse. He still gives you innings. Kuroda's been the ace of this staff. He has been the rock. Pettit has given you what he's given you. You know, he's been in and out of the rotation with back injuries and everything else. But Phelps has been terrific. Hughes has been spotty. He's been in and out. But the bottom line is they get good starting pitching. The starting pitching gives them length. It strengthens an already great bullpen that they have, which they're showing how good they are even without Jabba Chamberlain. And they're getting timely hitting. Not, you know, the lineup isn't busting at the seams. They're not scoring a million runs, but they're scoring runs when they have to. They're a gritty bunch.
The pitching is keeping them in the game, as you said, and it gives the offense enough time. And a perfect example of that was the first game in Baltimore, which they won in extra innings. If I remember correctly, over the first eight innings of mm-hmm. play, the lineup was 4 for 26.
Correct, yes.
And they scored three runs.
Right.
In the ninth and tenth inning, they were 5 for 10.
Right.
And also scored three to win that game 6-4 in 10.
Right. So they need that pitching to kind of, if, you know, to hold leads.
And it's that collaborative effort you talked about. You know, CC Sabathia gutted it out and kept the team in the game, you know, until he left.
Didn't have his best stuff, but he gutted it out.
And then Preston Claiborne, comes in, holds the Orioles right where they are.
Right.
Sean Kelly got a big out. Preston Claiborne held it down. David Robertson came in, and Mariano Rivera, what can you say about him?
The Angel Swarm.
He is the new Mr. Perfect. Forget the WWF guy.
The late Mr. Perfect.
Yeah, sorry. It is Mariano Rivera. But you brought up the injured pitchers, and one of those, which you could read from Lou DiPietro, is Ivan Nova. Brian Cashman said he should be the first one back off the DL, and he could fall into Saturday's start against the Rays, which Vidal Nuno is scheduled to throw.
Right.
Or you could see Nova back for the Subway Series finale against the Mets next week at Yankee Stadium.
You know, and looking at, you mentioned Vidal Nuno, and I'm going to go back to Nova real quick, but I do want to say, you look at the production that they're getting from the pitching that wasn't even on the roster to start the season, the Preston Claibornes, the Vidal Nuno with that scoreless start. That's an example of, you know, how good the Yankees could be. Nobody's talking about Adam Warren either.
He was tremendous too.
Adam Warren has been a tremendous long reliever. He's doing his job this year.
Another four scoreless innings his last time out.
He is eating up innings when the Yankees need him to eat up innings. And they had a couple of threats in that game where they could have come back. They ultimately lost, obviously. But again, they're getting contributions from everybody. And Ivan Nova coming back and taking Nuno's spot. You know, I don't know. You know, the thing with Nova is he's another one that's just been so inconsistent. And he comes back and you want to see what he can do. You want to see what he can do. But to me, when the rotation is fully healthy, I'm giving the spot to Phelps. Phelps, to me, has earned the spot in the rotation, and to me, Nova would be the odd man out. But right now, they need Nova because of all the injuries, like you said. And the fully healthy rotation is really a dream right now for the Yankees. If they can get everybody 1 through 5, to me, Phelps earns the spot over Nova. Nova's the odd man out. But they really do need Ivan Nova.
Right, I agree now with you with Phelps and the Nova argument. I just think that David Phelps is a ton more consistent than Ivan Nova. You just never know what you're going to get out of Nova when he takes the mound. Same thing with Phil Hughes. I mean, the guy starts the season, and you got to give him a break on that first outing in Detroit when he was called up. He was supposed to be in Scranton for a rehab assignment, and he gets called up at the last minute to start in Detroit against that lineup on a Saturday afternoon.
Right.
And he got knocked around, so you can't really give him too much guff for that. But, you know, his first two outings of the season lasted only 7 innings. And then he goes out there and throws no less than 6 over his next 4. And then giving up just 6 runs over those 4 starts. And then the next 2 starts, he gives up 13 earned. And the previous one to this one against the Orioles, Joe, he lasted, what, a third of an inning?
Yeah, and again, Claiborne comes in, he gives him 2 innings, Warren comes in, and they kind of kept things at bay, but it still was a blowout. I mean, it was a ridiculous
game. It was unbelievable.
But the thing with Hughes, to me, is he's all about location. When in that 4-game stretch, we saw a 92 to 93 mile an hour fastball that had movement on it, that was going kind of down and in to lefties and away to righties. And then he would throw that slider that he had, and then he's got that good curveball. So he was mixing up his pitches. And then all of a sudden, we see the Phil Hughes that's throwing the flat 92-mile-an-hour fastball with no movement up in the zone again, where hitters are just feasting on it, and away we go. Phil Hughes crushed.
Here's the thing.
He hasn't, you know, for a guy that's been around since 2007, you know, he needs to be more consistent. The consistency is still not there, and it's 2013.
47-38 career, because he got a no decision in his last outing against the Orioles. 47-38 with an ERA of 4.75. There comes a time, Joe, when you have to institute Bill Parcells' logic here. You are what your record says you are. And unfortunately, that's what Hughes is. He's a marginal starter at best. He's not a top-of-the-line guy as he was projected. He's a 4 or 5 starter in the major leagues. He just is. Yeah. And here's why. A source who will remain unnamed because I don't want to get the source in trouble, but told me, have you ever thrown a fastball in your life? Of course I have. Do you have any movement on it? Well, I throw the 4-seam and I throw a 2-seam.
Right.
You're a major league pitcher. You have that much giddy up in late life on the ball, and you don't throw a 2-seam fastball?
That's the truth.
That is Phil Hughes' problem.
That's one of the things that, you know, everybody throws a 2-seam now. They all throw a 2-seam to complement the 4-seam.
But Hughes has that 4-seam that's flat, as Joe said, and what is Hughes? Is he a ground ball pitcher?
No, he's a fly ball
pitcher. He's a fly ball pitcher. And when that fastball gets up in the zone and it gets the meat of the plate and you have these major league hitters there,
it's true.
That's what's going
to
happen.
I'm not trying to get on the kill Phil Hughes bandwagon here, but I am saying that when he is on...
It's just stating fact.
When he is on, he's a very serviceable, you know, mid-rotation pitcher.
This is what drives people crazy, Joe.
And then all of a sudden he comes back, and he gives up the home runs, and he throws the flat fastball. It's mind-boggling to see him from start to start. And it's really a head-scratcher when you're sitting there, and you know, I'm in the press box, and I just go, wow, his fastball is moving tonight. It's on. Look at him. He's just mowing down hitters. And then the next start, you just see him, and it's the same old Phil Hughes.
8 shutout innings against the A's, who were the most prolific run-scoring team at the time. And then 7 runs against Seattle. Seattle's lineup, 7 runs in a third of an inning.
I know. And the 47-38, like you said, if you look at the record itself.
Plus the 6 runs in 5 2/3 against Kansas City.
Yeah, I mean, and you said you are what your record says you are. You know, the record of 47-38, it doesn't sound bad on the front, but he also was given the gift of a lot of run support over the years.
That year he was 18-10.
Yeah, and look.
He had the highest run support on the staff.
And he had an unbelievable first half. I mean, that was Phil Hughes' shining moment as a starter.
He was in the All-Star game.
Yes. I mean, he was ridiculous. I think he was 11-2 at that point.
11-2, 11-3.
Yeah, I mean, he was ridiculous. He was just – that was the Phil Hughes that everybody, you know, thought that they were going to see at this point. And – right now, it's basically back to square one.
Let me be clear. I'm not saying Phil Hughes stinks.
No.
I'm just saying Phil Hughes is not what Phil Hughes was projected to be. That's all. I think he's still a very serviceable pitcher in the major leagues. But that's the thing that drives people crazy about Hughes is the fact that he's so inconsistent.
Just compare what Phil Hughes does to Hiroki Kuroda and CeCe Sabathia. And I'll explain this. Hiroki Kuroda, over his unbelievable stretch that he's had to start the season, has told the media and has shown during the game, I mean, he didn't need to tell the media that he didn't have his best stuff. But what did he do? He battled through. He threw the just enough pitches that he got his outs that he needed to get. And he battled and gave the Yankees innings, and ultimately, he pitched a good game. Phil Hughes doesn't have the capability of doing that yet. It seems like when things are down, when he doesn't have his best stuff, again, CeCe Sabathia didn't have his best stuff, but he kept the Yankees in the game. He battled through. He did what he had to do. He made adjustments mid-game. He did what he had to do to stay in the game and do what he could to keep the Yankees in the game. Phil Hughes, he gets down, and it's like, and the floodwaters come in. And he doesn't know how to make adjustments on the fly.
Anybody could go on the mound, wind up, and throw. There's a select few who know how to pitch. There's a difference between throwing, knowing how to throw, and knowing how to pitch. You could throw 100 miles an hour. If you don't know how to pitch, you're worthless.
Right.
It's as cut and dry as that. And it was just explained beautifully by Joe. The two main examples on this team, and you know, we brought it up on BP the other day, Meredith and I, we were talking about how Hiroki Kuroda, arguably, and it might not even be an argument, going into his start, where he got roughed up a little bit by the Orioles, and it was, you know, the roughing up came before he got hit with that line drive in the second inning, because he gave up two first inning home runs to the Birds, one to Markakis and one to Chris Davis, who's, you know, you can't leave a two seam fastball waist high to Chris Davis.
Right.
The guy's just, he's swinging the bat unbelievably right now. But we brought it up, you know, these two guys are the most consistent starters for the Yankees now for the past 2 years. And CeCe Sabathia even called Hiroki Kuroda the ace last year. You know, CeCe Sabathia, we know what he is.
He's the horse.
That wasn't a knock on CeCe Sabathia. No. He's not knocking himself, and nor were Meredith or I knocking CeCe on Wednesday. But into the game, Kuroda was 6-2 with an ERA under 2. You know, just call it what it is. Kuroda is the ace of this staff.
I've written two columns this year, about how I think that Kuroda, and this was in April. This was, you know, early on in April, and then I wrote another one after, you know, in mid-May, where I said that Kuroda was the ace of the staff. And, you know, the reaction was, you know, CeCe Sabathia is still the ace. And I said, no, the Yankees have two aces, but really it's a 1-1A right now. And if you look at...
That's a better way to put it.
If you look at Kuroda's numbers since last July 18th, the guy, you know, in 25 starts... is just on another planet, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing things that really you can make an argument that over that span, he's not just the Yankees' best pitcher, he might be the best pitcher in the American League. That's how good he's
been.
And,
you know,
it's like 14-7. His ERA is in the low twos.
I didn't really realize this.
Yeah.
But his ERA... Now, if you were to say a pitcher was moving from the National League to the American League... And the American League East.
Yeah, he's thriving.
What would you say his ERA would be? If you were to just prognosticate what his ERA would be.
I probably high threes.
It would go up.
Fours. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
In L.A., his career average out there, with a record, by the way, under 500.
Yes.
His ERA out there was 3.45.
Right. So you'd think
going into that start on Wednesday against the Orioles. Was it Wednesday?
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday against the Orioles, Kuroda's Yankee ERA was just over 3.
Right, and...
Just over 3.
So, basically, you have to... Again, I can't say this enough. You got to give the scouting team and Brian Cashman a lot of credit for recognizing that this guy had something special. He had something that they knew that, you know, the normal, you know, NL pitcher, the... Carl Pavanos of the world would, you know, make that move and it wouldn't be successful. And coming especially into the American League East. But they saw that there's grit to Kuroda. There's fight to Kuroda.
He just knows how to pitch.
He's a battler. He knows how to pitch. He's got an array of pitches.
You know what he has? He has a two-seam fastball.
Yeah, and he's got but it's not just that. He's got an array of pitches.
He does.
And he knows how to work out of jams. Yes, he had a high ERA. He was trying to work his way, you know, into American baseball. You know, he had the mid-threes ERA. But he comes to the Yankees, and like I said, he might be one of the best pitchers in the American League.
And, you know, they might be getting some help, not in the very near future, but maybe towards the middle of the season, not only in the lineup, but the pitching as well. Michael Pineda in the Jesus Montero trade, by the way, Montero optioned to AAA Tacoma with the Mariners with his 208 average, 3 home runs, and 9 ribbies.
And I believe everybody in that trade is now not on the major league level.
The only one is Hector Noesi.
And I think he got sent down.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. So there is nobody from that trade that is on the major league level.
But I'll give you this update on Pineda via Lou DiPietro. He threw 5 innings in an extended spring training game on Thursday. His fastball topped out at 93. He'll throw one more time in extended spring. That's on Tuesday, the 28th. Then he will begin his 30-day rehab assignment, which could have him off the DL and back in the Bronx, who knows in what capacity, on July 2nd. He could be back in the majors. Cashman said he's got his velocity, he's got all his pitches in tow, but he also put up this flag. Until he's in game situations against better competition, he has plenty of hurdles to overcome. And that's the truth. But as Joel Sherman said earlier this week in the Post, he's absolutely right. This trade, you know, who won this trade is still up in the air because we haven't seen what Michael Pineda can do. But if he could lasso some of that magic that he had first half of the season when he was with Seattle, Yankees could have lightning in a bottle here.
The Mariners optioned Hector Noisy to Tacoma. So, yeah.
So no one. And Jorge Campos, I'm hearing, could be the best piece in this trade.
He could be. He's struggling this year. But look, Campos, the thing with him, last year he started off in Charleston very strong. And then he basically broke his shoulder. So, you know, he didn't – that wasn't released.
He didn't tell anybody either.
That wasn't released until, you know, this year. But again, he's on the comeback trail. He's on the mend, and he could be a very good piece in this trade. You know, we'll see. But you could also see Michael Pineda coming back after all the rest he's had, and just kind of being what they thought he was going to be, or what he pitched to that first year with the Mariners.
And he's in better shape too.
Yeah, and you know, they threw his arm out by the end of that season. I mean, I believe he was pitching with an injury. He went from having like a 95 to 97 mile an hour fastball to a 91 mile an hour fastball.
Yeah.
So, you know, if his velocity is even, you know, 93 to 95, he's got movement on his pitches. You know, he showed that he had that. You know, the Yankees could be big winners in this trade.
Well, maybe that's why they're going to throw Nova back into the rotation, because if Pineda starts having some good outings in his rehab, in his 30-day rehab stint down in the minors, Nova better, you know, he's on watch.
Of course
he is. Because you can't really put David Phelps on watch. He's just done a tremendous job, as you said.
Right.
But the Yankees are also, you know, they're close to getting a couple of these lineup guys back as well. Mark Teixeira, he's eligible to come off the DL on June 1st. Cashman said he could begin a rehab assignment in Trenton on Tuesday. If it's the same as Granderson, could be back Sunday, June 2nd against Boston. He's been playing in simulated games all week. He had a handful of at-bats Thursday. Told the Associated Press he is almost ready to take that next step and get to Trenton on Tuesday. But here's my dilemma, Joe. And it's been put out there by a couple of the beat writers, and I just don't know how. And listen, it's a great problem to have.
Right.
I just don't know. And we put up a comparison between what Overbay and Teixeira have done through 40-some-odd games.
And Overbay's having the better
start. And Overbay has actually started out better. Now, I'm not saying Overbay is going to hit 30 home runs.
Compared to Texas last year.
I'm not going to say he's going to hit 30 home runs and driving over 100 RBI. But I just think he brings a different dynamic to that Yankee lineup. You know, you could bat him pretty much anywhere, and Joe, he uses the entire field.
Right, something that Teixeira
used to do,
right. And he came here, and like most guys that, you know, are hit for power, we know he's a switch hitter, but, you know, when he hits from the majority of the left side of the plate, you know, he looked down at that 314 and said, look at that. And, you know, Giambi fell victim
yeah.
to it.
Yeah.
He's fallen a little bit of a victim to it. And, you know, the shift has been, you know, they're basically playing the third baseman at short when he's there and the second baseman almost on the, you know, the right side of second base. And, you know, he's just got to learn, or not even learn, he's just got to start to use all fields again. But, again, nobody's questioning his defense. Nobody's questioning his ability to come back. But, again, Overbay brings – you know, Lyle Overbay brings a little bit of a different difference to the game because, you know what, Chris? He's somebody that's trying to prove, you know, not just to the Yankees.
Hey, I'm not done.
If the Yankees decide that they're going to go with Teixeira and, you know, Overbay might be a victim of numbers, you know, Overbay has shown basically the rest of baseball, look, I can be a serviceable, a very, very serviceable, good defensive and offensive option at first base.
Here's the conundrum right now.
Which, by the way, you don't think the Mets wouldn't want Lyle Overbay right now?
Yeah, with Ike Davis playing the way he's playing. But you have David Adams, Reed Brignac, Robinson Cano, Jason Nixon, Lyle Overbay. Those are your five infielders on the 25-man roster right now. Adams, Brignac, and Nix are all on the 40.
Right.
Mark Teixeira on his way back. Kevin Youkilis is on his way back. And let's not forget the original left side of the infield in Alex Rodriguez and Derek Jeter. Yeah, they're down in Tampa too. A-Rod is 3 weeks into baseball activities. He's running. He's hitting in the indoor cages and taking ground balls. Jeter and Cervelli still healing. They're not doing anything baseball related. But it brings up the question, and here it is. Overbay only plays first base. Okay? Right. You have Youkilis, who plays both corner infield positions. You have Jason Nix, who could play short and third. He's valuable.
And be a fourth, fifth outfielder.
Right. You have Eduardo Nunez, who could play short and third and could spell Robinson Cano at second as well. So he's extremely valuable. Reed Brignac, I don't know what they'd do with him. He may be an odd man out. David Adams, how could you get rid of this kid? I know his injuries have been his boogaboo over the years, but – gosh almighty, it was him who put the kibosh on the Cliff Lee deal, wasn't it?
Yes.
When he was with Seattle?
Yes. He's showing why the Yankees, you know.
Why they wanted him. Absolutely.
Yeah, and not only that, but, you know, he's really just been, he's been lights out. He's a good player. In high school, he played third base. But for the majority of his minor league career, he was a second baseman. And then he realized that, you know, with Robinson Cano basically planted there for, you know, however long he's going to be there, you know, guessing that he's going to get a contract from the Yankees after the season, you know, he was the one who said, I'll move back to third base, especially now. And he's played a very good third base.
And he's hitting.
And by the way, he's got more hits than Ben Francisco has.
What is
in a
the
full
love
season.
Affair with Ben Francisco?
I don't know. I really don't know.
What
You know, he's.
Why is he still on this team?
I don't know. Now he's basically the fifth outfielder because they have Wells, Ichiro, Gardner, Grandy, and
Ben Francisco.
So to me, does
this fall into like he's a Girardi guy? Does Girardi like him? Or?
I honestly don't know what the love affair is, especially that Grandy is a switch, you know, Grandy's a lefty, I'm sorry. Especially that, you know, they come back and I think they're just looking at it, they're very lefty heavy in the outfield. But honestly, I don't know what the love affair is. He can hit. He's made some, you know, interesting moves in the outfield. They played him at DH. To me, if Tex is the first one back, let's say Tex mm-hmm. is the first one back, I think we say goodbye to Ben Francisco. I think he's the first one out.
I think he needs to be.
I think he's because they're gonna give Tex an opportunity to have his days off and try to heal up. Because you know what? He's not going to be fully 100% when he comes back. So they're going to give him the time, and that's where Overbay is going to shine. That's where basically they're going to say, okay, Tex, you're back. Let's do, you know, four games on, three games off, something like that, or a mixture.
But then
the other
problem is then you bring Youkilis back into the fold, and he could play first, and he could play third. Then you have to start making decisions about David Adams. Then you have to start making decisions about Overbay again.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Joe, you're not 100% Teixeira's not going to get hurt again with the wrist. You're not 100% that Youkilis is going to keep himself off the DL.
Right.
How can you afford to let this guy go? I mean, buy the guy an outfielder's glove and have him start shagging fly balls.
I know.
I mean, if it comes down to that, I mean, that's – you have to keep him. I know it's tough and I know – the numbers are against him, but what he's done and what he's meant to this team. And let's face it, you could trade Lyle Overbay, but who are you going to trade? What are you going to get for Lyle Overbay?
I know.
What are teams going to give up for him? Not too much. Let's face it. So I think the Yankees, they have to find a way. And I'm confident in their baseball people, along with Brian Cashman, to find a way to keep this guy on this team.
It really is a conundrum because, you know, like I said, these guys have been so good, and they've been, you know.
And the clubhouse, you could speak to the clubhouse. How good is the clubhouse this season?
I mean, you got guys like Vernon Wells, who's just a tremendous, tremendous guy. Lyle Overbay is one of the nicest baseball players I've met. Really, Travis Hafner, very low key, cool guy. It's a very nice clubhouse. I'm not saying that previous years haven't been nice, but this is a group of guys that, you know, they continue to say the right things, and they are veterans, and they're mature, and even the kids they're bringing up, the Preston Claibornes, if you didn't see the interview with Meredith.
I did. It was tremendous.
And David Adams, they're very mature for their age, and they're very, you know, just all of them are just, you know, they're on point, they're good kids, they're good veterans, they all get along, and Hafner and Wells keep saying it, they're having fun. That's the theme of this team. They're all having fun.
Well, as long as they keep winning, they'll keep having fun, and it could get a little dicey over the next couple of weeks here. They have Tampa this weekend. And then they go and they have their four games set with the Mets, two at City first and then two at Yankee Stadium after that. And if they don't take at least three of those games, there's something wrong.
Absolutely.
And then after that, they have Boston. They welcome the Red Sox back. And then after Boston, the Indians before they go back out west. So it is a tough stretch.
Tough stretch. And look,
through the first week of June for this Yankee team.
And Mets and Yankees, look, the Mets are terrible. We know it. Harvey's going to pitch one of those games, so who knows what the Yankees are going to be able to do against Harvey. And look, the Mets are always up for those games. So even a terrible Mets team, don't be surprised if it's a 2-2 split. I mean, really, would that surprise you as awful as the Mets are, that they wouldn't take
it? It wouldn't shock me.
They're going to – I mean, they could at least take one. I mean, that's
– I'm giving them the Harvey game, but yeah, they don't score runs for the kid.
They're just awful.
I was writing the show the other day, and I never really looked at the numbers for the Mets pitching staff, but Matt Harvey was 5-0 going into his start with a 1.55 ERA, going into a start against the Reds in the last game on Wednesday of that series. He gave up 4 runs that day, okay? That was the most runs he's given up this season in a start.
Oh, and
8 of his 10 starts, Joe, 2 runs or less.
And I heard somebody call into the Fan and say, oh, he finally faced a great lineup and he came back down to – are you kidding me?
Came back down to earth. 8 out of 10 starts,
are you
2 runs
kidding
or
me?
Less.
This guy
and
is,
by the way
– Justin Verlander, by the way, who's the best pitcher in the league, is having – a very mediocre start. So are you going to say, oh, Justin Verlander, who's probably the best pitcher in baseball? Oh, Justin Verlander, yeah, he's come back down to earth. Stop it.
Stop.
Just stop.
By the way, 1.55 ERA, it's up to 1.93 now.
I know.
God forbid.
Awful.
But 1.55, okay, going into that start, 5-0. The other 4 Mets starters, a combined 5 wins, and the next closest ERA to that 1.55 heading into that start. Well, screw it. 1.93 after the start.
Was Jonathan Neese, right?
4.80.
Yeah, Jonathan Neese. And what's funny, I saw Dylan G was at 6.
Ugh.
And what's his face? Sean Markham was 5.5.
Yeah.
And they're just terrible.
It's
bad baseball in Queens. I don't mean to pile on, but it's bad baseball.
Well, that's what I said yesterday. You know, if you want proof of pitching being the San Andreas fault for the Yankees this year, get a Metro card.
Yeah, go to Queens.
And head over to Citi Field.
It's funny because you look at Harvey. Harvey's been good. Harvey's been more than good. Bobby Parnell has been pretty serviceable.
At this point, I don't know. I really don't know why Wheeler isn't up. I really don't. Why not?
And why not at this point?
Why not?
And not only that, but
let him grow up here.
You know, if you're a Mets fan, the thing that's really disheartening about the Mets, and again, I'm not trying to pile on the Mets here. We've switched to Queens right now because the series is coming up and it is a relevant topic. The Mets thought that they had something. The future was bright with their rotation, where Harvey was going to be, you know, number one or two. Wheeler was going to be a number one or two, however that worked out. And Neese was going to be their solid number three. And then 4 and 5, they could have gotten basically decent pitching from anywhere. They thought G might have been a four or five. And they could have gotten a piece somewhere else. The thing that's truly disheartening is the fact that they thought their infield was solid. That, you know, you were going to have for the very near and hope, you know, they were hoping the very far future.
Ike, Reyes, and Wright.
Ike, Tejada, Wright, And then the, you know, Buck right
well,
now.
Well, before they traded Reyes.
Right. Well, no. But Tejada, even Tejada. As yeah. They thought they had something in Tejada. Mm-hmm. Buck behind the plate right now. Darnold coming up, you know, being, you know, what they hoped was the next Gary Carter.
Yeah, the outfield's a mess.
Though. The outfield is not a major league outfield. It's not even. There are outfields in the minor leagues that are better than the Met outfield right now. And the disheartening part about it is that essentially – you've gotten production out of John Buck, who slowed down a bit. You've gotten, a David Wright season, who's a very good player. You know, not all worldly, but he's a very good player. And you've gotten nothing else out of anybody else. So they need to rebuild the outfield. They from right now, it looks like they need to rebuild the infield. They need to kind of rearrange the bullpen and. They need to rethink about their rotation. So they're in a heap of trouble. And Sandy Alderson, I know Terry Collins is going to be the guy that's probably going to take the fall for this, but it is not Terry Collins' fault. He was not given any talent. This team is untalented, and the GM is the one that should fall on the sword. Because, honestly, it's truly the ownership over there that's just atrocious. But they're not going to fall on the sword. So Sandy's the one that really, you know, Sandy's the one that needs to go, not Terry Collins. But, again, it's going to be Terry Collins that goes.
The Mets have 17 wins. Mariano Rivera has 17 saves. That's all you really need to know so mm-hmm. far about this baseball season when it comes to the New York baseball teams. How about the New York hockey team that's still alive?
I'm wearing my Devils jersey, by the way, in protest.
Now, listen, I guess I went on Facebook right after that win, and I said, I should kill them every day on the damn podcast. And I should, because every time I do, it seems that they pull wins out of their rear ends, and they pulled one out of their rear ends last night. That goal by Carl Hagelin to start the scoring for the Rangers after they go down 2-0 was something right out of like a CYO youth hockey league game. Tuukka Rask trips over his own skate blade, and Hagelin, who just weakly threw a backhand at the net, it just trickled by. Like, Rask looked like a little kid with his stick trying to stop that puck, like hitting it up and down on the ice and couldn't stop the puck from going to the net. Gave the Rangers some life. The building came to life. That building, you could hear a church mouse fart before that goal went into that, before it went into the net. The power play has been, it's been anything but a power play. They were 2-for-38 going into last night. They were 2-for-41 before Brian Boyle scored his to tie the game at 3. And the kid from Boxford, Massachusetts, Chris Kreider, Kreider man, does whatever a Kreider can, scores the goal in overtime. And they live to play another game.
This is also the Chris Kreider that essentially John Tortorella was saying sucked, right? This is the same guy. I'm going to say this. You have to give the Rangers credit for battling back.
Henrik Lundqvist that one. They owed him.
They essentially didn't have the lead the entire game, right?
They didn't.
Because they were down 2.
No, they didn't.
They came back. Yeah, they didn't have the lead the entire game.
They tied it at 2. They tied it at
3. The only time they had the lead was when they won the game.
When they won in overtime.
So, honestly, you have to give the Rangers a lot of credit for staying in that game. That's the magic of playoff hockey. They showed a lot of guts coming back. They really, you know, battled on a night where it looked like it was going to be a sweep. But in front of their home crowd, they showed that they weren't going to go gently into that good night. And again, look, they had a lot of guts. I still don't think they're going to have a miraculous series comeback. But Henrik Lundqvist, if you guys out there continue to bash this guy, whoever out there is a Henrik Lundqvist hater, the only reason why the Rangers are even in this position is because of Henrik Lundqvist. This guy is all world. There were 10 to 12, maybe even more than that, legitimate scoring chances that he basically snuffed out. He stopped 37 pucks. You know, there were 40 shots on goal. There were 10 to 15 times where the Bruins had legitimate shots to get the puck past Henrik Lundqvist.
The reason
he stopped every one of them.
The reason Hank gets all this stuff from these fans who basically, to me, know nothing about anything. They're just deflecting blame from where it should be being placed. How many goals have you scored in the NHL postseason?
Right.
How many? Answer me.
Zero.
How many have I scored?
Zero.
You know how many Brad Richards has scored?
One.
One. One more than you and I. You know how many Rick Nash has scored?
Yeah, one.
One more than you and I.
I know.
And we don't put skates on.
These are their big...
That's the blame. Derek Stepan has four. He's the New York Rangers' leading scorer, goal scorer.
Yeah,
in the postseason.
And Nash and Richards were... Richards is lost. Richards is completely lost at this point.
You know...
Nash has shown signs of you know, being Nash.
He has flashes, but he's got to put the puck in the net.
Put the puck in the net.
You cannot not put the puck in the net when you're the stud on offense. And he should be shouldering just as much of the blame if a weak goal gets past Henrik Lundqvist. I'm sorry, Ranger fans, but the Devil fans sitting to my right, your left, if you were watching us right now, he's absolutely correct. Henrik Lundqvist is all world. And if he wasn't between the pipes, this series is over.
I mean, right now,
to me,
Henrik Lundqvist, the one thing that the Rangers have that a lot of other teams don't have, including the Bruins, I'm sorry, Rask is, you know, it's all right. But the Rangers have the best goalie in the league. It's bottom line. They have the best goalie in the league right now.
I'll be completely honest with you, too. No one's beating the Pittsburgh Penguins.
No,
Nobody.
I agree with that.
So if Boston survives and advances, good luck with the all-star team in Pittsburgh. And it's not an all-star team like the Dodgers.
And by the way...
This all-star team actually works.
Well, and not only that, but all that needed to happen in this series was the sleeping giant that was Sidney Crosby. He gets the hat trick, and that's it, and away we go. They win that game 4-3.
7-3 the next game.
Yeah, and now all of a sudden, they're all back. Crosby got his confidence back.
Crosby, Morrow,
yeah,
Iginla.
It's
Dupuis is playing like freaking Jaromir Jagr in his prime.
Yeah, they're in a position where they're head over heels the best team in the league.
Yeah, and the Blackhawks, you know, who got out to that great start. And I said this to some Blackhawk fans that I know. I said, you know what? You could win 30 or 40 in a row. Doesn't matter. Get to the postseason. That's when you have to win the games in a row.
Exactly.
That's when you have to win. Exactly. Not in the regular season. The President's Trophy means absolutely what? Nothing. You get a consolation prize. You don't want that President's Trophy.
As a Devils fan, the Devils...
They didn't even touch it.
The Devils never won the President's Trophy. Never. And they had all those great teams. In fact, in 1995, they swept the team that won the President's Trophy. The Detroit Red Wings were the best team by far in the league that year. And then they ran into the buzzsaw that was the New Jersey Devils. And that President's Trophy meant zip to that team. Scotty Bowman and Sergei Fedorov and Steve Yzerman, if you asked them, they would trade that President's Trophy for that Stanley Cup any day. Mm-hmm. So
it's really it signifies that you had the best season in the NHL, but when it comes down to it, when teams win it and they bring it out on the ice, the players don't even touch it. They don't want that.
No.
They don't want any part of the President's Trophy. And this is why it's kind of a, you know,
it's like winning the conference trophy too. They want nothing to do with the
conference. Yeah, they want nothing
trophy.
To do with that either. They don't, you know, they lean in to take their picture. They don't pick it up. They don't want that. They want the cup. They want the cup. And you know what? The Blackhawks are one game from being ousted by the 7th seed in the West.
Yeah.
7. 7th seed Detroit Red Wings, who if they didn't have that late run towards the end of the season, wouldn't even be in the playoffs.
Wouldn't be in the playoffs. You know what, though?
That's why you love the NHL.
And the NHL playoffs are so great. But again, that's that culture that they have in Detroit. Detroit is not the best team in the West. They're not even close to being the best team in the West. In fact, they were terrible for most of the season. But you know what? There's that culture, that winning culture in Detroit that, you know what? Even the Blackhawks were the best team in the West record-wise. You know, coming into that series, they had to be like, man, the Red Wings again. This team, it doesn't matter, you know, what players are on the ice. It's about the uniform. It's a lot like the Yankees with the Red Wings.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot like the Yankees with the Red Wings because those guys have a pride in putting that uniform on and a pride in playing in front of that crowd in Detroit. And you know what? When there's meaningful games on the line, it doesn't matter who's wearing that uniform. Man, they're going to be a tough out, and they're showing that right now. They're a good team.
It could be an elimination weekend in the NHL playoffs. The conference finals could be set up because the Bruins are up 3-1. If you ask me, I think it's over. I mean, I'm happy the Rangers have, you know, I get to watch another game, but I think it's over in Boston.
The problem with this 3-1 is, you know, and the 3-0 that it was, is it's not like it was, you know, it's basically they're coming – if the Rangers win in Boston,
Come
back to the Garden. So they could make it 3-3, but ultimately they're going to end up in Boston. And that's just I don't even think it's going to get to that point, which it probably – 99% won't get to that point. But again, it all goes through Boston in Game 7.
And have the defibrillators around because you know what? I think I saw something on Twitter. I'm just going to guess at it. I think it's either 22 of 26 or 22 of 28 of the last Rangers-Bruins game have been decided by one goal. So if you're watching the game tomorrow and if they get by that one and you're watching a game six, just, you know, strap yourselves in because it's going to be one of those bumpy rides. It's not going to be a 4-1 Rangers victory. It's not going to be a 5-2 Rangers victory. If they win, it's going to be basically, you know, edge of your seat. Overtime, winning by a goal. It's unbelievable the way these playoffs are going.
I don't know if you've been listening to the flagship show of WFAN, but some great analysis by the host of that show, which I won't name because he is on the Yes Network. But I got to tell you that that Marchand, who plays for Boston, that Marchand, he's an impressive little player. I didn't know anything about him before this series, and he's showing me a little something. That Marchand, is that his name? Marchand? Yeah, Marchand.
No comment. I will not touch that one with a 10-foot pole.
And I'm at the point I don't care.
But like I said, going back to what I said before, I'm just happy that the Rangers are playing one more game. And I think that's all it's going to be is one more game. I'd like to have it be more, but I'm a realist. They've just been so inconsistent this year. I just think, you know, the Bruins are pretty much, like I said, outplaying, out-hustling, outdoing everything that the Rangers can do. The fourth line, like the Devils' fourth line in the EC Finals last year did to the Rangers, they own them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just sit there and you scratch your head like, oh, my God, really? The fourth line is going to put us in the coffin again? And, you know, there's one nail left, just one. And remember what I said yesterday. And I wasn't breaking any news. The entire history of the league, 0-3 deficits have been overcome three times. The 1942 Cup Finals by the Maple Leafs, the 1975 quarterfinals with the Islanders, and the 2010 Eastern Conference Semis, Bruins losing to the Flyers.
Right.
So it went 33 years before the next one, 35 years, so Ranger fans, relax.
Right.
It's probably going to be about 37 years before the next one happens. It's not going to happen. It'd be nice. It would exercise that Yankees-Red Sox 0-3 comeback for, you know, Ranger fans who are Yankee fans like myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a realist. It's not going to happen. They're not winning three straight games against the Bruins, the way they've been playing, the way the Bruins have been outplaying them and out-hustling them and getting to the loose pucks. It's how the Bruins took the 3-0 lead. In Game 3, you thought the Rangers would have some life. You thought the Rangers would, you know, they brought that 1-0 lead into the third period. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, okay, Hank's standing on his head tonight. I could actually see him doing his little fist pump and getting out of here with a 1-0 win. Then the Bruins score. And then I basically said, it's over. The way they're playing right now, because, listen, the Rangers are not the Devils. They're not running the trap, okay? And they don't have the Devils' defense that they had when they won their three cups. Because if they did, that 1-0 lead would have stood. And you would have been looking at it down 2-1, and now the series 2-2 instead of 3-1. It might not even be 2-2. The Rangers might have swept them if they had the Devils' defense.
I'm not.
They might have.
Not arguing with you.
They might have. Martin Brodeur is a great goaltender. I'm not taking anything away from Brodeur. But the system and his defense.
Yeah, I mean.
When he only has to stop 15 shots. When he only has to stop 12 shots. I mean, that speaks a lot to the system, and it speaks a lot to the defense and the players he had in front of him.
Yeah, I mean, even on nights where it was, you know, you'd see him stop like 27 to 30 shots. I mean, there'd be like 5 scoring chances.
Right, right. But at the same time, you know, I'd be remiss not to say he has made some unreal saves in his time. And last year against the Rangers where he kicks his leg up in the air and stops it. I mean, okay, really? Really?
Look, bottom line is the Rangers, even if they – look, if they win this series, Chris.
Oh, God, if they win this series.
You know, you're going to have to go on probation again. But they're not going to win the series.
Double secret probation.
They need to look at themselves in the mirror in this offseason and figure out what they are. Because you made a great point with the fourth line. They don't have a fourth line. And a lot of these teams that are...
Right now, they have 2 kids on it.
Yeah, and you look at a lot of the teams that have won Stanley Cup championships. They've had depth. That's the key, depth. You know, getting good production from line 1 to line 4. And when line 1 isn't working, line 2 picks them up. And when line 2 isn't working, line 3 picks them up. And then that fourth line, it's gravy when they're playing great. But if they're playing, you know, consistent, then, you know, you have a lot of strength in numbers. You have a lot of depth.
You know,
I'm going to go back to my Devils in 95. You look at the crash line. The fourth line, Mike Peluso, Randy McKay, Bobby Holík. I mean,
yeah, Bobby Holík on your fourth line. Your fourth line's doing pretty well.
Enough said.
But anyway, I'm sitting there at home and I'm on my couch and I'm watching this Boston fourth line last night in the game and I'm saying to myself, God almighty, when I used to play NHL 94, my fourth line hardly even saw the ice.
Yeah.
and this fourth line is killing us right now. But, yeah, that's where my mind goes to when I'm watching hockey. But whatever.
Hockey is a tremendous, tremendous sport to watch this time of year.
In my opinion, and it's my personal opinion, I think it outweighs the NBA playoffs immensely. The NBA playoffs, they have no flow. There are too many fouls, and for LeBron James to go 200 minutes without a foul being called on him, something's wrong with the NBA.
My problem with the NBA is
has
always been it's just the postseason's way too long. Way too long. I just feel like, you know, we're going to be going to mid to late June here before they crown a champion. And I'm not saying, look, I've watched the Heat and the Pacers. And I got to tell you, it was an entertaining, you know, entertaining games here. But
the game one was an entertaining game.
Right.
Towards the back stretch, I think the last 8, 9, 10 minutes of the game, it was within 5 points either side. The biggest lead any team had was 7.
Right.
It was an entertaining game, but at the same time, it's not as good as college basketball. You have to let these guys play. These superstars and their babied treatment where they look at the official, they posture at the official waiting for a foul while the other team is running down the floor, you know, on a power play basically because they're not getting back on defense, slumping their shoulders because their ego didn't get a foul call.
Mm-hmm.
It drives you crazy. It really does. But anyway, I think that's a good place to end it right
I think
there.
So too.
And I'm glad to see PJ Carlissimo, by the way, good guy, up on ESPN getting some work during the NBA playoffs.
And kind of burying the Nets a little bit.
Well, I just think PJ's a good guy.
I do too.
He was always good with the media. He was always good with me. And I think he's a good basketball man. And I'm just glad to see that he's out there and he's getting some work. And we'll wrap it up right there.
Perfect.
As A Tribe Called Quest once said, to loot means to maraud. In this case, we maraud for ears. It's the Off the Wall podcast. Joe Auriemma, Chris Sheeran. We'll see you next time on YesNetwork.com.
The Off the Wall podcast comes to you each week on iTunes and YesNetwork.com. If you like what you're listening to, simply subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you have an extra minute, leave a comment and rating.